This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Robert Duvall, the Oscar-winning actor whose roles in both blockbuster movies and small independent films were equally powerful and memorable, died Sunday. He was 95 years old. Born in San Diego in 1931, Duvall studied acting in New York City alongside such other future stars as Dustin Hoffman, Gene Hackman, and James Caan. Duvall was performing at Long Island's Gateway Playhouse when screenwriter Horton Foote saw him and recommended him for a part in the movie Foote was adapting. The movie was To Kill a Mockingbird, and Robert Duvall was indeed cast in his first screen role as the silent but haunting Boo Radley. Duvall was 31 years old, but never stopped working afterward in film and TV. His last two credits were in 2022, 6 decades later. Duvall's contributions to film were constant and indelible. The characters he played were passionate, intense, and often combative. Tom Hagen, the consigliere in The Godfather, earned Duvall his first Oscar nomination. The role of the napalm-loving Lieutenant Colonel in Apocalypse Now earned him his second. Eventually, Duvall won a Best Actor Academy Award for playing a country singer in Tender Mercies. But whether or not his roles garnered nominations or awards, they certainly made their mark with audiences. He played the uptight Dr. Frank Burns in Robert Altman's original movie version of MASH. The ruthless TV executive in Paddy Chayefsky's Network. A cynical sports writer in The Natural opposite Robert Redford. And the abusive father in The Great Santini. On television, Duvall played Gus McRae, the charming Texas Marshal in the CBS miniseries Lonesome Dove. In the 60s and early 70s, he clocked a lot of episodic TV, including episodes of The Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Outer Limits, and even The Wild Wild West and Mod Squad. Today, we're going to remember Robert Duvall with two conversations, one with Terry Gross, the other with Dave Davies. Terry Gross spoke with Robert Duvall in 1996.
So your father was in the military, in the Navy,
yes.
I believe?
Yes, he was.
He was an admiral?
Well, he retired as a rear admiral. His active rank was captain. He went to the Naval Academy when he was 16 years old and graduated the class of 1924. He came off, you know, a farm in Virginia. And went to one of those one-room country schools down in the woods, and then graduated. He went to high school when he was 11, and you know, and he went to the Naval. He waited a year, and he went to the Naval Academy when he was 16. So it was all, He was a career naval officer. He was 39 during the war, the youngest captain in the Navy. He was in destroyers and so forth, but he was a career naval officer.
I bet your father didn't want anyone to think that he was the character in The Great Santini.
Well, he is not. Well, kind of. Actually, my father was a lot quieter than that, so that character was a little more boisterous. And there was some. Let me put it this way: in the book, The Great Santini, it said there's an imperceptible passing of the mantle of the husband to the wife, of the wife to the husband when the husband comes off of duty and is at home for a while when he takes over the family. There was no transference in my family. My mother ran it at all times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she did.
Robert Duvall is my guest. It's interesting, you know, the Godfather films are such, like, operatic movies with, you know, people playing gangsters who are given to grand displays of emotion and violence. Yeah. And you're the one in the movie, the legal advisor, whose job is to advise, to be discreet, to tone everything down.
Right.
So in a way, you're playing a very opposite type of personality than all the other personalities in the film.
Yeah, well, it was a pretty interesting character in that he was an adopted son plus this legal advisor. So therefore, as an actor and as the character, you really can't cross the line. You're kind of an outsider, but yet you're not an outsider. I really enjoyed the part. Those first two Godfathers, that's about as good as you can get filmmaking wise. I think
I agree.
Francis was at top form, although as you say. Maybe a touch they romanticized the organized crime to a point, but it was such good filmmaking. You can excuse that.
Do you have any favorite scenes in the Godfather films?
Well, there were a lot of them I liked, you know. I mean, the one with Michael Gazzo in Godfather 2 where I have to tell him he has to, slit his wrist, that scene. And the scene where I had to tell Brando that Sonny died in Godfather 1, that was nice. And there were other scenes I liked a lot, too, but those kind of come to mind very quickly.
My wife is crying upstairs. I hear cars coming to the house. The Consigliere of mine. I think you should tell your Don what everyone seems to know.
I didn't tell Mama anything. I was about to come up and wake you just now and tell you.
But you needed a drink first.
Yeah.
And now you've had your drink.
They shot Sonny on the causeway. He's dead.
Now, you worked with Francis Ford Coppola again on Apocalypse Now.
Right, right.
And in Apocalypse Now, you were Colonel Kilgore,
right.
Famous for the line...
But I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Is that the one?
That's
smells
the one.
Like victory, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a wonderful line. People come up to me and quote it to me as and say it like it's such an in thing between just me and them. And like it's like they're the only ones that ever thought of it. But that happens with everybody the same way.
Did you get the script and say, well, first of all, was that line in the script? Or is that something that you
Yeah, no, that was in there. And I think the part was offered to somebody else and they turned it down. And I said to Francis, I know that the part's written for a bigger guy, real tall, big guy, but, you know, I'll just say once, I think maybe I could do the part, and I'll put in my plea. And he gave it to me, so it was enjoyable. It was a lovely part, and I enjoyed playing it very much.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb for 12 hours, when it was all over, I walked up. We didn't find one of them, not one stinking body. Smell! You know that gasoline smell? A whole hill. Smelled like... victory.
So when you saw the line in the film, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, did you say to yourself, a classic line, people will be repeating this back
to
me?
No, I didn't. I didn't think of that. I didn't think of it that way. I wasn't sure. You know, I mean, sometimes you're not so aware of that. Although you like lines like that.
Did you do a lot of different line readings on that? I love the smell of napalm. I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
The one that was most predominant, there was Jimmy Keene, a friend of mine who played a small part in that from Buffalo. I made him call me Mr. Duvall for a year because that was a relationship in the movie because, you know, but we're all on a first-name basis. But he's saying, now, how do you do this? And he was watching me, and he did great imitation. We were always doing imitation. So the final dress rehearsal before we filmed, we were always doing Brando imitation. So I said, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. I paused, and I said, smells like victory. I did my Brando, and he couldn't believe that I would do that, you know. So then he began doing Brando imitations. So then when Brando wanted $100,000 to do six lines of the censored stuff for the censored version of the TV version of The Godfather, and they wouldn't pay him, they got Jimmy Keene from Buffalo for $200 to do Brando.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So those imitations started in the Philippines, and Jimmy got, because of those imitations, blossomed into the guy that would do the censored version for Brando.
Hey, they could have saved a lot of trouble with Brando and Apocalypse Now, I guess.
I suppose, yeah. Well, Jimmy was the guy that was there that told me all these wild stories after I left. See, I did the second half of my part first, and then 6 months later came back into the first half. It was strange the way I had to go do another job because they got so bogged down with weather and with different actors and approaches and so forth. It took a long time to complete that film.
It must have been really different working with Coppola on the Godfather movies than working with him on Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, well, you see, I had worked with Francis in The Rain People, as I had said.
And that was in the late 60s.
Kind of a moody guy, and I didn't quite get a handle on Francis. But then I gained a tremendous amount of respect for him because on Godfather 1, we started out, I said, okay, this is Francis again. He's not saying much. A little moody, you know, the way he is. He's a real, he never comes out. I want to write a book someday called The Rushes Are Great because everybody protects everybody by saying The Rushes Are Great. Francis is one of the only guys that comes out of the cutting room with a long face, and maybe that's why he's so good in that he isn't always thrilled, you know. But I gained a lot of respect for him because in Godfather 1, physically, they had an understudy director following him around in case he failed to fire him and take over. And he worked under that pressure. I don't know how you would do that with a guy physically, like, over your shoulder in case we... And I think the first AD was the best friend of that would-be hopeful director. That's quite a lousy thing to do to a director, and I gained a lot of respect for Francis for working under that pressure.
When you were young, Brando was one of your heroes, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was quite a phenom. I mean, there were others too, but he. And then you grow away from somebody's influence and find your own way.
So, what was it like to work with him when he was much older? He'd physically changed. It wasn't, I think, a particularly good period for him.
Well, no, in The Godfather, he was very rather trim. Yeah.
Right. But
and when I first worked with him, Apocalypse. Yeah, I wasn't really there when he worked.
Right.
I worked with him first in The Chase way back, and the first day he called me into his dressing room and we talked about the part. I said, to my wife, this is going to be great. We're going to be like brother. We had a great rapport. Then he never spoke to me again for 8 weeks. I wasn't quite used to that lifestyle of somebody not speaking to you at the beginning of a day, but that's the way he is, I guess. But I was respectful and admired him and enjoyed working with him. And as I say in Apocalypse Now, that he came into the jungle with his baby blue Mercedes driving down the jungle, after I had left. And then when I came back, he'd finished,
So tell me, when you were young and getting started in acting, what were your expectations? What did you think would come of your career?
Well, maybe I was innocent, and maybe innocence not the same as naive. Maybe it is. I always felt that somehow I would fit in. I went to New York feeling I would be a stage actor. I didn't think a lot about movies. I thought about them, but I wasn't sure. I just figured I was going to work. I didn't know how, but I figured it would happen. And when I got one of the worst reviews anybody could ever get, I went back to Virginia for a while, and then I came back again. My friend Udo Grossbard, then we had done A View from the Bridge, and we did it again off-Broadway, and it was a wonderful production with John Voight. Dusty Hoffman was assistant stage manager, Susan Ansbach, Ray Bieri, Richie Castellano. It was a wonderful production. That helped launch get more into film and TV,
So if you don't mind my asking, what did that terrible review say about you?
I'm going to tell you exactly what it said.
You still remember.
It said, Shaw has invented some impossible young men in his plays, but never one so revolting as the romantic young interest in this one. And the character is made even less palatable by Robert Duvall, whose spine tends toward a figuress, whose diction is flannel-coated, and whose simpering expressions are moronic. Now, that's a pretty bad review.
Yeah.
And the other paper likened me to Liberace, so I had to get off the bus.
Liberace?
Yeah, I had to get off the bus. I was physically ill.
What was the connection to Liberace?
I don't know. Maybe I played him a little feet, or I don't know what it was. It was a guy from the Actors Studio. I don't know. He had us lying down doing Sense Memory before we were doing George Bernard Shaw. I said, we should be telling jokes, not lying on the floor for Sense Memory. It was the whole approach was wrong. It was a disaster. But, at least it was an experience, at least.
Well, Robert Duvall, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Robert Duvall speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. In 2010, Robert Duvall visited Fresh Air again, this time to be interviewed by Dave Davies, who asked about his immersive acting technique.
I read a fair amount about you, and people talk about your ability to completely disappear into a character. I forget which director said, it's almost eerie that Robert Duvall becomes that character. And then I've also read you say, no, it's work. I mean, you prepare and you bring some of yourself to it. You never leave yourself. You don't transform.
Never.
And at that moment—
If you do, you're in trouble.
Okay.
Yeah, you do. It's like play acting. Kids play house, right? And here we play house as grown-ups. We get paid good money to play house. So it's a game, really. It's a game of, it's a game. You become the character, but it's really you turning yourself in a certain way as if you become the character. But you cannot lose sight of who and what you are. You have one set of emotions, one psyche, one soul, and you don't become another thing. It's you. It's all those things turned to what seems to be something different.
You did so many memorable supporting roles earlier in your career in the 70s. In fact, I read in a piece in the New York Times that one problem you had was that audiences didn't always recognize you from one movie to the next because you disappeared so effectively into those roles.
Right.
One of them, of course, was the consigliere Tom Hagen in the Godfather roles.
Right.
Did you realize that these were going to be such iconic films as you were making them?
Absolutely. I mean, a third of the way through, I said, Godfather 1, I said, this is going to be pretty important. And I can remember when the film was finished and we had an opening night party. I think it was at the St. Regis Hotel. And there was a wonderful buzz and a wonderful feeling around the whole film of Godfather 1. And I remember I won't mention names. A well-known film director came up and said, "You boys did a wonderful job in this movie. I want to congratulate you." He said, "I don't know about the movie," he said, "but and this guy never made a movie that good ever." I won't mention names.
Okay. All right.
So anyway, but there was always that feeling that, wow. And then Godfather 2, it went in. But Godfather 2, we didn't have Jimmy Conn on the set, so it wasn't as much fun.
Well, then, there was Apocalypse Now.
Right.
And
with Coppola again.
Right, right. And your portrayal of Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore.
Initially, the character was called Colonel Carnage.
No kidding.
But they had to water it down a little bit. That was a little bit too much.
A little too obvious.
Yeah.
Just tell us a little bit about you getting into the head of somebody who would love that gasoline smell and bodies burned so badly you couldn't find him.
Yeah, well, you just have to just go and do it. I was in the Army as a draftee, and I used to didn't know I'd ever play a guy like that. But I mean, out of curiosity, I used to just watch some of the special service officers and the way they behaved, the way they stood. And when I got over there, they had the character as Carnage, and they changed it to Kilgore, and they had him in a cowboy hat and boots. And, some of the Marines and so forth, the more hardcore military, say, well, this didn't go on. Well, it did go on because I understood that the head general of the air cavalry used to deer hunt on his own along the Cambodia border on Friday nights, and his helicopter was shot down and he was killed. These guys did crazy things.
He was deer hunting from the helicopter?
Yeah, from the helicopter. And I was told that by a gentleman who had served, with the air cavalry. I mean, I guess guys, you have to have hobbies to break up the monotony. So, people have hobbies, I suppose, even in wartime,
Your character's hobby here was surfing.
Yes.
Was that in the script? Yeah. Did you come up with
that? Yeah, all those things were in the script. Yeah, very much so.
Well, I want to talk about Tender Mercies, the 1983 film for which you won the Oscar for Best Actor.
Yes, sir.
In this one, you were a Max Sledge, right? A once popular country singer whose career had dissolved in alcoholism, finds himself in a little Texas highway motel where the widow who runs it kind of takes care of him, and he puts his life back together.
Yes.
And I thought we'd listen to a clip here, and this is late in the film, where you have, as Max Sledge, have heard that your daughter has died in a car accident, a daughter you had just reconciled with after many years apart. And in the scene, you're hoeing in the vegetable garden, and your wife, who's played by Tess Harper, comes up and asks if you're okay, and here is how you respond.
I was almost killed once in a car accident. I was drunk, and I ran on the side of the road, and I turned over four times. And they took me out of that car for dead, but I lived. And I prayed last night to know why I lived and she died, but I got no answer to my prayers. I still don't know why she died and I lived. I don't know the answer to nothing, not a blessed thing. I don't know why I wandered out to this part of Texas drunk and you took me in and pitted me and helped me to straighten out and marry me. Why? Why did that happen? Is there a reason that happened? And son and daddy died in the war. My daughter killed in an automobile accident. Why? See, I don't trust happiness. I never did. I never will.
And that's our guest, Robert Duvall, from the 1983 film Tender Mercies. You know, as I hear that again, it's such a powerful moment. And this man feeling such pain, it's so intense, never raises his voice. You want to talk a little bit about him and this character?
Yeah well, this scene in particular, I remember that. I said, look, I would rather not loop this. Let's get the sound right. Because you're outside, so they put trucks around and we didn't have to loop it, but we did it.
When you say loop it, you mean like provide an ambient kind of sound?
No, will you add your voice to your voice to make it clearer at the end in post production?
Oh, I see.
You dub it, so to speak, And I didn't want to do that. And they hung back with the camera and didn't come in on close-ups because sometimes close-ups, it spells it out too literally. And they left the camera rolling and it kind of worked for me.
And as TV critic, I'm thrilled that this portion of Dave Davies' interview with Robert Duvall, who died Sunday at age 95, is devoted to the 1989 CBS Western miniseries Lonesome Dove. Based on the Larry McMurtry novel, Lonesome Dove was and remains one of the best miniseries ever made. And though Duvall didn't win the Emmy Award for which he was nominated that year, his performance was one of the best he ever gave in television or film. He plays Augustus Gus McCrae, who, like his best friend, Captain Woodrow Call, is a former Texas Ranger. Woodrow is played by Tommy Lee Jones, and the two men are very different. Duvall's Gus loves life and shows his emotions. Woodrow doesn't. In this scene from Lonesome Dove, Woodrow comes upon Gus, who's weeping over a lost love. Their conversation turns to prostitutes, and to one with whom Woodrow apparently has fathered a son.
I don't know why you sit down on whores, Woodrow. You've had yours, as I recall.
Yeah, and that was the worst mistake I ever made.
It ain't a mistake to have been a human being once in your life, Woodrow. Poor little old Maggie left you a fine son before she quit this world.
You don't know that. That boy could be yours or Jake's or some damn gambler.
Yeah, but he ain't. He's yours. Now, anybody with a good eye can see it. Besides, Maggie told me. We were good friends.
I don't know about friends. I'm sure you was a good customer, though.
Well, the two can't overlap, you know.
You're the one that didn't know about overlapping with whores, I reckon.
You know what hurt her most? You wouldn't call her by name. You never would say Maggie. That's what hurt her most.
I don't know what it amounted to if I had.
It would have made her happy.
What are you talking about? She's a whore.
Well, whores got hearts, Woodrow, and Maggie's was the most tender I ever saw.
Well, why didn't you marry her then?
She didn't love me, she loved you. You should have seen how she sat in that saloon every day watching the door after you quit coming around.
I reckon the man has got more to do than to sit in a saloon with a whore.
Like what? Go down the river every night and clean his gun? Maggie needed you, you let her down. You know it too, don't you?
No, I don't know anything of the dang kind.
And that's why you won't claim that boy as your own, because he's a reminder, see? A living reminder that you failed somebody. And you ain't never going to be up to admitting that. Now are you?
Like I said, Maggie was just a whore.
Well, I got Woodrow. At least you finally called her by name. I guess that shows some improvement now, don't it?
And that's my guest, Robert Duvall, with Tommy Lee Jones in the series Lonesome Dove. You know, you guys are both, you mount and ride horses as you're having that conversation. You were both horsemen, right?
Yes, sir. Back then I was really, I rode everything back then. Jumping horses, English saddle, Western saddle, yeah, especially to get ready for the part, yeah.
Did you know Tommy Lee Jones? Had you worked with him before?
No, I met Tommy Lee when we were going to do that. I went to his ranch down there in San Saba. We talked. We herded cattle in Argentine polo saddles. We went out, and I got to know him. I haven't seen him too much since because he lives way down there, and it was a good experience working with him and all the women. It was a wonderful experience, wonderful. My ex-wife, who lives there in Philadelphia, Gail, she was the one that told me to read this book. She liked it better than Dostoevsky, a great, great novel, and that to make sure that they gave me the part of Augustus, not the other part, which they were going to give me the other part. But we talked and arranged it so that I could play Augustus, you know. So if she's listening to the show, I want to thank her for that.
And Augustus fits you better. Why?
I don't know. It's just, you know, because I've played those more covered guys before, but, you know, this was more of a muted guy. But with he's a more outgoing guy, Augustus, and suited a certain side of my personality as much or more than the other part, really. James Garner was, they offered him the part. I said to my agent, he handled us both, if you can get him to switch parts, I'll be in this, and I don't want to play the other part. So he called back a few hours later and said, well, James Garner can't be on a horse for 16 weeks. I said, well, okay, now go after that part, and he did, and so he got me that part, so I really, really, I really loved it. I really did. My favorite, probably.
Yeah. This is a film about a cattle drive, and
yes.
I don't know if you use stuntmen at all. I mean, I guess you and Tommy Lee did not, right?
Well, the only time they used a stuntman when I had to ride down among the buffalo, which was little hair, but I did most all my own riding. And my horse got a little iffy, so they put me on a ranch horse, a local ranch horse, which were good and more sound, so to speak, and well broke. But then that was working great until the pistols went off, and then this horse started bucking, and I stayed on for about 4 or 5 seconds, and then I bailed, or he helped me bail, and the cowboys were laughing. Oh, give me a 75 on that ride. They were all laughing, and I said to the director, you know, get a cutaway me on the ground, getting back on. So they were able to use it when the horse actually bucked, and I came off, so they really used it. But, you know, I did all my own riding. I took the horse to the ground when I had to slit his throat and use him as a shield. And the stuntman, Rudy Uglin, showed me how to do that. So I was glad that I could do my own riding, you know, because it was, that's because they were only horses then, no cars way back.
Yeah, you know, that really was one of many moments that I remember from that series. You're being chased by a bunch of guys,
right.
About seven or eight guys. You're not going to outrun them. And so you quickly dismount, cut your horse's throat, drop him so that he forms a shield,
yes.
And you fight these guys. It's amazing.
Yeah, and Rudy and those guys showed me how to drop him because he was a falling horse by training.
Robert Duvall speaking to Dave Davies in 2010. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating a century of supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org/100. And from the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Dave Davies and his 2010 interview with actor and director Robert Duvall. He died Monday at the age of 95.
You wrote and directed the film The Apostle in 1997.
Yes, sir.
A story
and financed.
Oh, that's right.
Right. Yeah.
Right. The thing that gets forgotten but that's so hard to pull off.
Oh, boy.
This is the story of a Pentecostal preacher that you play, a flawed man who faces a crisis in his life when his wife finds another man and he is ousted from the church that he's the preacher. Tell us where this came from. What was your experience with Pentecostal Christians?
I was doing an off-Broadway play called The Days and Nights of B.B. Fenstermaker, a wonderful play by William Hartwell Snyder that just was terrific. And I played a guy from Hughes, Arkansas, so I was flying back from California to New York, and I got off the plane in Memphis. I said, let me go to Hughes just to see what it's like. Not that you have to do that to be an actor, but I decided. So I went back, and there was no place to stay. The highway guys building a highway from Louisiana let me bunk in with them. I walked down the street at night. The sheriff gave me dirty looks. It was strange. But there was a little white clapboard church I went into, and I'd never been to something like that. There was a woman preaching, a Pentecostal preacher, and I said, I've never seen anything like this, even in my own country. I want to put this on film someday. So it took me many, many, many years to get it off the ground, and finally I did. You know, when my wife came up, I finally got the go-ahead to do it, and I did resume my research that I did all over America, and she said, hey, Bobby, you think we'll ever go to any white churches? Because I love the black preachers. They're like surrogate fathers for their community, and it was a great, great experience. Great.
Right. And, of course, this isn't just about Pentecostal culture. It's about a truly fascinating character, I mean, your guy.
Yes. I pieced it together from many, many, many stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a tribute to the film that I watched this again over the weekend, and I still can't tell whether I like this guy or not.
I like him okay, because let me put it this way. What he did by killing a guy just out of the moment is not half as bad, one iota as bad as King David, who wrote the Psalms, who sent a man off to die by design so he could be with that guy's wife. That's what David did, but my guy just did it. So my guy wasn't as bad as some people, you know. I mean, these guys, a lot of them start out, and some of them end up charlatans on TV. But I think even if he had his moves and his whatever, at the core of his being, he really believed in what he believed in, I think. So it was a labor of love, but, you know, something. I mean, I heard Billy Graham liked it, and I got a wonderful letter from Marlon Brando. He liked it, respected it, so I got it from the secular and the religious.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you how evangelicals reacted to it. Yeah, they liked it.
Well, some didn't like it, I think, but you know, I mean, I talked with Pat Robertson. He just thought it was right on the money. It just was terrific, you know. And I mean, most people, you know, I get letters from people. My father was a Pentecostal preacher. My uncle was, and you got it exactly right. So I feel, you know, right. And there's always somebody, you know, like right. Some people didn't like The Godfather. Come on, you know. Great, great movie. So,
well, Robert Duvall, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for a wonderful interview, a wonderful job. Thank you.
Robert Duvall, recorded in 2010. He died Sunday at age 95. Here he is singing a song from the film Crazy Heart.
Nobody here will ever find me. I'll always be around, just like the songs I leave behind me. I'm gonna live forever now. Your fathers and your mothers, be good to one another. Please try to raise your children right. Don't let the darkness take them. Don't make them feel forsaken. Just lead them safely to the light. And when this old world has blown us under and all the stars fall from the sky, just remember someone really loves you. We'll live together forever, both you and I. I'm gonna live forever. I'm gonna cross that river. I'm gonna live forever now.